Welcome to the Scariest Things Podcast, episode 26.
Dun, 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 dun.
Scariest Things is your gateway to the tropes and trends of the horror genre, where tonight we are talking about the best sequels of all time.
All right.
Or at least
it's a challenge because there's a lot of, I mean, more often than not, they're pretty shitty. But
there is an S-ton of sequels out there. And it was kind of shocking because a couple weeks ago we talked about
remakes.
We talked about the best remakes, and there was an awful lot of remakes out there, and sequels, there is an awful lot of sequels. But where did you draw a line with the sequels? Did you say, like, if a film has like seven sequels, it's not on the list? Or did you say if it's got like one solid sequel, then that's a sequel?
I think all the ones that I have at least four sequels or more.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
So, but I think that you could make a case that they're all franchises. Some of the franchises stretch out.
I gotta look here. Yeah, you know what? I take that back. I just debunked my thinking on that subject because I was thinking, no, a couple of mine are only. It's like they just did one very smart and very elegant sequel, and then they called it a day. But in fact, all mine are in the 10 and 12 plus range.
I have one of my films that is my an alternate, just in case I stumble into you in a collision in one of these things.
Mm-hmm.
That is a 2 of 2.
Okay,
but it's bound to get more.
But is there? Did you have any specific rules for sequels, or were there any films that you thought, boy, that the original was so good, mm-hmm, they don't need to make a sequel? Then they make a sequel and you go, oh, well, the sequel was okay.
I didn't make the rule where the sequel has to be better than the original.
Sure,
right. There are a few cases that are like that.
Yeah.
By and large, I'm not a fan of sequels.
Yeah, because it is, you know what it is? It's money grubbing.
Yeah, no,
it's a lot of money.
Exactly,
grubbing. And it's those money grubbing bastards in Hollywood.
And I think horror movies fall prey to that almost worse than most other types of films because they are so inexpensive to do.
Right.
That once you realize you've hit upon a nerve.
Yep.
You keep going back to it until people just stop coming.
And, until that nerve is
And you don't
dead.
Need that many people to keep... There's, you know, how many Puppet Masters have there been, right? Now, that said, I'm really looking forward to the Puppet Master of the Littlest Reich that is coming to the Portland Horror Film Festival.
Yes.
But
go to the Portland Horror
Film. I think there's 12 Puppet Master movies. Eight 12 Puppet Master movies.
There's 8 Wrong Turns.
Yeah. It's just
I have no idea how many Final Destinations there are.
And part of the problem is movies that get built so that they take on sequels tend not to be the kinds of horror movies that I really gravitate towards.
That's true. I mean, it's got to be, like, if you're getting into the 3, 4, 5, 6 range, there's got to be a really strong story, mm-hmm, and or there's got to be an incredibly clever arc than somebody thought right through, and you know, 9 times out of 10 there is no arc,
right?
It's just like, how do we come up with an interesting way of rebooting, mm-hmm, you know, or continuing on with
because at some point, like, the villain's not dead,
right?
How many times do Michael Myers and Freddy and Jason come back? It's sort of like, you know, that it's like they say the final chapter is never the final chapter. I mean, it's a joke.
Yeah,
it's a final chapter when the actor is too old to do the role and they can't find anybody to recast it. Freddy Krueger.
Right, exactly.
Right.
You know, I saw Judas Priest recently. This is apropos of nothing, save for the concept of the final chapter. And at the end at the end of the show, they flashed up on the big screen, "We will be back." And I thought, really? Maybe they should have done "We will be back," Question mark.
if they're
but that's what I feel. I feel like with a lot of these, you know, I think I feel like a lot of these, it's like the, you know, the setup has become, you know, it's a trope in and of itself. Mm-hmm. Like the expectation that they gave you just enough of a hint that we will be back, that the killer will be back.
There are some movies that will never get sequels because that they are so of. You know, self-contained stories that why the hell would you do one? Like, there will never be a sequel to The Shining.
Right.
There will never be a sequel to Misery. There will never be a sequel to Get Out, I hope.
Right.
Well, actually, there's going to be one. But how do you reconnect those dots?
Unless it's a prequel.
But it's still, even then, I mean, because the thing
that could be an interesting prequel to how they came about. The whole
think about
the one film that you think that could absolutely not have a sequel, The Exorcist, and it had two sequels. I mean, granted, it actually had four sequels technically.
And one really good one.
Yeah, one really good one. But I mean, and technically none of those things are connected. I mean, they don't have anything. They have very little to do with one another, save for the third one. Right. Well, actually the third one is in Washington D.C. and actually the second one ends up in Washington D.C.
Right.
That's about all they have to do with each other. I mean, the second one obviously has Linda Blair, but you know, not in the same.
Vein. Linda didn't earn the Oscar nod the second time out.
Not in the same vein.
So yeah, I think there are some periods, and we just talked about the golden age, and I think the 1940s were riddled with a bunch of cheap knockoff movies.
Wolfman versus Frankenstein, Frankenstein versus Dracula,
Abbott
Dracula
Costello versus
Dracula versus the Mummy, Mummy versus Frankenstein.
Everybody
Frankenstein.
Versus everybody. And then you had the 1990s, which was your multitude of Screams and Final Destinations, and everything was franchised. And it frankly was lazy.
Yeah.
There's like, come up with something original, please.
Yeah.
I don't begrudge people for trying to sequelize things because I know.
Yeah, people got to make money. Yeah, they got to make money. They got to put food on the table. They got to earn a living. So yes, but you know, try to be a little bit more clever.
People. Right, and there are a few franchises that I look forward to the sequels, and I think I'm going to.
I do not look forward to the podcast where we cover the 1990s.
No, that's going to be grim.
Not looking forward to that one. That one might be. A harsh toke, as the kids say.
I think the late 40s and the mid 90s were probably the most devoid of any good horror movies.
Yeah, I would agree. All right, so what do you got? What do you got for number four on your Fearsome Foursome list of the best sequels of all time?
Well, we just talked about this movie.
All right,
keep
going.
So when we were talking about Golden Age, Bride of Frankenstein.
Oh yeah,
1935.
Yeah, absolutely.
Getting the band back together. So this is the original sequel, right? Yeah. I mean, think about it. I mean, this is
they realized
Universal said we got a hit on our hands.
They didn't do a Freaks 2,
but Freaks 2 would have
the freakening.
That would have been awesome.
Freaks 2, the freak party.
But James Whale came back and directed it, so that helps. Boris Karloff and Colin Clive both reprised their roles. They swapped out the role of Elizabeth, changed the actresses, but pretty much brought the band back together. And Elsa Lanchester is spectacular and just sort of untouchable as the bride.
Yeah.
They are Universal, as we've talked about recently, has been trying to reboot their universe. They've talked about having, Angelina Jolie be the bride. And I was like, God, don't touch it. Just leave that one alone.
I think Universal Studios, if you're listening to Universal Studios, you would be well to consult with Eric and I.
Yeah. Don't make it into an action
movie.
We do not
charge a very steep fee.
Make... sympathetic monsters in the Universal Monsters. It's what you have. You should know what you have, what the property is. And you don't get more sympathetic than the monster and the bride.
That's right.
But not just, okay, there are some, to revisit what was in The Bride of Frankenstein. So how does you say, well, Frankenstein died in the first movie. He was burned in the windmill. No, he managed to escape the windmill. And it follows immediately after. It isn't just like, 5 years later.
No. It's right on the button.
Famously the fisherman who parades around with his dead daughter in Frankenstein because Frankenstein accidentally kills the little girl. It was a great
spoiler alert.
Yeah. another spoiler alert, the fisherman wants to make sure that the monster's dead, so he goes looks for the body, but he stumbles across Frankenstein, and Frankenstein kills him, and then he kills his wife.
Right.
So it's like, well, that closed that chapter. That whole family is gone. And then the locals go, he's still alive, burn him! And so when you hear the terms, pitches and pitchforks and torches,
right.
This is
they're talking Frankenstein, yeah.
And so the mob comes out again, can't find him, because he hides out with the hermit.
Right.
Who teaches him how to love music, and teaches him to talk, and teaches him to eat, to drink wine, and smoke cigars.
Right.
In a way that was brilliantly parodied in Young Frankenstein.
Yes, absolutely.
Which was just that was part of my favorite. Look, Young Frankenstein's got so many great things to it. But this, it showed a little bit, it had a little bit of a lighter touch, and again, sympathetic Frankenstein.
Right.
And then the mob finds him and burns down the hermit in his house. And then Frankenstein is lonely, or the Frankenstein's monster, right? You can't call him Frankenstein. The monster is lonely again. And Henry Frankenstein, who's just feeling down in the dumps because he's been accused rightfully that he created a monster that just, has been terrorizing the town and killed many people. His mentor comes to town and kidnaps him and his wife to force him to try and recreate his experiments. And when they actually get, they capture the monster, and monster's lonely.
Right.
And so he wants a friend.
And there's some great, like almost like pre Ray Harryhausen kind of miniature effects in the film that, like, when you watch it even today, you go, huh, that's really interesting. Yeah, but how did they do that?
Well, because it's the only thing that they were, to explain what Mike's talking about, is the only successful things that they've been able to recreate are these little miniature people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But, when Bride meets Monster and she hisses at him and screams, it's one for the ages. And so there are a lot of people who will say that The Bride of Frankenstein is a more sophisticated, more fun take on the Frankenstein monster
than the original. Well, I showed Bride of Frankenstein and Frankenstein to my youngest son, who is a burgeoning monster lover. Uh-huh. And he preferred Bride of Frankenstein as well. So if viewed through the prism of a 7-year-old, Bride of Frankenstein wins out every time.
Yeah. So this is, but I think one of the other funny things is that the title of the movie shouldn't be Bride of Frankenstein, because that's Elizabeth.
Right.
It should be Bride of Frankenstein's Monster.
Right.
To be technically accurate.
Yeah. But
so
Frankenstein just sounds.
So that's going in the Wayback Machine. It's an old musty favorite of mine.
All right. I'm bringing us back to present day.
Okay.
1988.
Okay.
At all present day.
Okay.
Phantasm 2.
All right.
Phantasm 2. This is, of course, written and directed, as many of these films were, by Don Coscarelli, starring, of course, Angus Scrimm and Reggie Bannister.
Rest in peace, Angus Scrimm.
Yeah, rest in peace. The interesting thing was that this film was somewhat controversial because Mike, the young boy from the original film, who was really kind of the lead character in the original film, was not brought back for the second film, for the sequel.
Was there an explanation?
No. They just cast James LaGrosse, And James LeGros went on to do like tons of great stuff, like Drugstore Cowboy and, you know, a million other things. But a lot of people were like, okay, James LeGros looks nothing like Mike. And who in the hell is this guy?
Well, you know.
So the film basically just picks up where the first the first film took place. You know, Mike, of course, is sent off to a mental institution. He escapes the mental, or he leaves the mental institution, convincing the mental institution that he is indeed okay. He goes back and recruits Reggie from the first film and some new friends, which we'll leave at that, to go out and defeat the villain, the tall man, played, of course,
Angus
Grimm. Phantasm 2 was followed by Phantasm 3, Lord of the Dead, Phantasm 5, Oblivion, and the final in the Phantasm series, Phantasm Ravager, which I think came out in 2016, 2017.
I have to say, I haven't gotten past Phantasm 2.
Yeah.
The at some point, it's how much diluted do you get? But Phantasm 2 is solid.
Phantasm 2 is solid, and it's an interesting film because whereas the first one, of course, takes place in some nondescript town in Oregon, which is clearly Southern California. This one, they travel across the Oregon countryside, which is clearly not Oregon; it is Southern California, and they end up in a town called Perigord, Oregon, which I will tell folks does not exist. There is no Perigord, Oregon. So don't go looking. Don't come to Oregon looking for Perigord, Oregon, because it don't exist.
Right.
The thing that's interesting about it is that, I think the thing that's kind of fun about it, but at the same time unfortunate, was that in the late 1980s, you started to see successes from the Die Hard franchise. You started to see your Terminators. You started to see your Rambos. All this kind of like machismo baloney, and a lot of those sensibilities were clearly brought to this. And it was like, well, you don't need a gun. You need a shotgun with four barrels.
Right.
You don't need a chainsaw. You need a chainsaw and a blowtorch. You know, and it was a lot of this like kind of like really ridiculous, kind of over the top.
Sure.
Weaponry that was entirely unnecessary for the plot, because there are some seriously legitimate scares in the film, and in particular, and hopefully I'm going to tease this out right now, because if we ever get to a goriest or grossest scenes of all time,
oh boy,
there's a scene in here.
We should totally do that.
Yeah, well, I know. I think it'd be a great idea. There's a scene where the young woman that Mike, the main character, has befriended, is kind of huddled off in the corner, and she's like shivering. She's got this cloak on, which like the little, and she looks like one of the little dwarf creatures.
You and the dwarves,
yes.
Mike.
Oh,
it,
man,
we have firmly
dwarves.
Established
those dwarves.
Dwarves,
and there's
Mike.
A lot of dwarves in this. There's a lot of dwarves in this one. And in fact, the young woman who they befriend, the grandmother of the young woman, turns into one of the weird sci-fi space alien dwarf creatures, which is freaky. But in this case, it's the young woman. They peel back the cloak that's on her, and her back starts to bubble and bursts out. Basically, her spine explodes, and sort of the Angus Grimm type character comes out of the back of her spine. And it's actually, I shuddered when I saw it. I was like, it was really, really shocking. And in fact, Variety magazine called it an utterly unredeeming, full gore sequel, incredibly morbid and meaningless. Which to me says, that's success.
Watch that one, baby.
That is success. All right, so what do you got for number three on your fearsome foursome list of the best sequels of all time?
Well, okay. So I am at serious risk of stealing yours.
I'm hearing a caveat here.
No, caveats here. This is absolutely one of them.
Okay, what is it? Lay it on me.
Dawn of the Dead.
There you go. That goes without saying.
You know,
it's not on my list.
Oh, it isn't.
Okay. It is not. Because I didn't really as we were talking about earlier, does the story have to carry through, or can it be kind of like just like somewhat somewhat like with the Exorcist franchise, mm-hmm. where like those are all somewhat disconnected, mm-hmm. and there isn't. Mm-hmm. I kind of felt like this was sort of fell into the same vein, where it's like it's loosely, you know, you're in Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. clearly you're in rural Pennsylvania, right. but beyond that. It's not super, well, it's not super connected.
I, you know, the way that I took it is that it's of the sequence, but that this is the environment has changed,
right?
But there's clearly been a 9-year time gap between the two movies, and it looked. Yep. I mean, certainly now you got, you know, it's in full color, and
right.
And this is also post MPAA. Now you can do your rated R, or in this right. case, I don't think they even went in for a rating on this one.
No, I think it was. I think it was rated R.
Yeah, but it was. You know, this is them. Tom Savini getting to show off and actually getting to star in the movie.
Yes.
But with you know, Ken Foree, David MG, Galen Ross, Scott Reiniger, who all play embattled survivors in the shopping mall. Yep. And this thing, it's iconic. It has been aped and copied and revered, mm-hmm. in all sorts of, whether it's you know,
the remake,
the Walking Dead show, any zombie movie that followed this one. It established the rules of, you know, shoot them in the head to kill them.
Yeah.
The slow shuffling zombies.
Uh-huh.
The fact that there's no explanation to why this really happened, other than the hell is filled up and the dead have, you know, they've come back to life. But it's suggested, but that's
right.
You know,
but again, it's interesting though. It kind of follows on some of the themes we touched on in our last podcast, mm-hmm. where we were talking about the golden age of horror is sort of that idea of like faith and science, mm-hmm. and voodoo and mm-hmm. magic and reality.
Well, and I think,
but it does kind of get into some of those things.
I think one of the brilliant twists, and it shows up very strongly in The Walking Dead,
mm-hmm.
is that the zombies are an environmental construct.
Right.
They are clearly dangerous.
Right.
But you can keep them at bay if you wall them off. But when society is under duress, Romero doesn't have a lot of faith in human society.
Right.
Right. And you know, Savini and his gang of hooligans who come storming through and wrecking the mall and making a mess of things, you know, they get their fabulously bloody comeuppance,
right.
as they get torn apart.
Well, even the main characters, you know, there's that great sequence which I always look back with some degree of fondness. But even the main characters, once they've completely locked down the mall and wander through the mall, there's the wonderful sequence where they're eating dinner and they go into the bank and they're horsing around, they're filling their pockets with money, they're going and grabbing whatever accoutrement they want from the mall. But it's what it all symbolizes is how quickly the breakdown in society happens, and how quickly people go for themselves, and really have absolutely very little consciousness with respect to
consumer culture. But the other thing that struck me is that it's not only is it greed and consumerism, but it's also how that leads to loneliness.
Right. I mean,
there is a real sense of isolation, and despite the fact that they have everything that they could possibly want,
right.
it's a very lonely
existence. And they do cover that towards the end of the film, where you see them. I think they're playing cards. Mm-hmm. They can't reach the outside world, mm-hmm. yet they have all the trappings of modern society. They have beautiful clothing. They have wonderful mm-hmm. food. They have mm-hmm. wonderful furniture. But
they're even armed.
Yeah.
But you know, I think and I think that.
But something is missing.
There is something missing, and there's something about the soul of within humanity that Romero is suggesting is society under duress loses that.
Yep.
Which is kind of, that's about as bleak a statement as you can make.
Right.
He has gone on to try and make similar kinds of statements in subsequent movies.
Yeah.
But he never quite got back to that real core notion that he did in Dawn of the Dead.
Right.
So that's King sequel right there.
All right. That was number three on your Fearsome Foursome list. Number three on my Fearsome Foursome list is another film that has the number two in it. This, of course, is Paranormal Activity 2.
Bonk. All right. So I'm going to have
a crossover. All right.
A crossover, so I have a backup. So
right.
We'll be okay.
Well, good. Good. All right. So Paranormal Activity 2, which we saw together because Eric and I did a paranormal pig out. We did 1, 2, 3.
Three in a row, yeah.
Yeah, 1, 2, 3 in a row. This, of course, is the second. This is the 2010 version, directed by a guy named Ted Williams, who I looked through Mr. Williams' resume, and he did Paranormal Activity 2, which I thought was really great. He has done no horror film before and no horror film since.
Really?
In fact, the films he has done are like so far afield from horror. It's kind of interesting, yeah. Huh. So I don't know, I don't know what the backstory was, but this film essentially takes place beginning 2 months before, and it follows up with the events that were depicted in the first Paranormal Activity movie.
Yeah, because Katie comes in and out of this thing.
She does come in and out of this film. This one's interesting because basically, this follows a family, a suburban family, and so what they do is they really cleverly play on like the security of the family, the worries, the sometimes warranted, sometimes totally unwarranted, fantastical worries of the parents, wanting to protect the children. It's a mom and a dad, a dog, two young kids. This one, they really like step up, significantly the possession, the reach of the demon, literally and figuratively, where the dog is freaking out,
the
teenage daughter is like in the middle of the street, the little boy is in the middle of the street, the little boy is, erect in his crib, the daughter gets drug into the basement. Right. They hit you like constantly with, in some ways, very, very similar scares, but there are so many friggin' scares.
I think this is one of the scariest movies I've seen. I mean, it just had, and it is, the things that are out of camera because they still know what they have. I think this at this point within the Paranormal Activity universe, they're still sticking with stationary cameras.
They do also play with the time,
right?
Which I think is a really critical element to those films. I think it's such a great thing that which hadn't really been explored in quite the same way. Where like a person standing at the foot of the bed for 3 hours, inexplicably standing there, a person disappearing for 2 hours, inexplicably, a person going down into the basement for 2 hours and then wandering back. To me, that's just terrifying because that's in some ways much more terrifying than kind of the visceral notion of a demon standing in front of you, caterwauling and screaming, because in that instance, it's total loss of that person where they've gone away and they've come back clearly as something different.
Well, and I think that the big thing with all these paranormal movies is that you can put yourself. It feels real,
right?
It looks
and this,
like
it's, this one. I think almost more than all of them.
Yes,
because it's you've got this really strong familial component,
right? And the actors, there's
nuclear family, and
unlike the movies that we talked about in our previous episode, when they all talk like this,
right?
And they're all very dramatic, and they all fall in love, and it's all about weddings. It's like this feels like the constructs of a modern family just going through their routine. Granted that they're being very cautious, and they have, and it makes sense to have the cameras where they do because they're taking some extra precautions. You put yourself in their shoes very, very easily. More so than like the movie that comes after this, I'm not as big a fan of. I know that you really like Paranormal Activity 3.
Yeah. I think this is probably the best, though.
It is. I think the first one was hamstrung by the tiny budget to some degree.
Yeah.
And the acting skills of Mika and Katie gets continues through this thing, and she gets better. But I think this one they were able to up their game. This is the movie franchise that built Blumhouse.
Right. Exactly.
So thank you to Paranormal Activities for giving us that fabulous production studio.
Yeah. No, that's a good one. That's a good one. All right. So what do you got for number two on your Fearsome Foursome list?
Okay. Well, I'm going to bypass the...
You got a solid list so far.
Yeah. I'm going...
Keep it going.
I'm going with a franchise... I'm going with Nightmare on Elm Street.
Oh, okay.
I'm going with Wes Craven's New Nightmare.
Okay.
Because this is the great meta... component of the franchise, because they bring back, you know, it got stale, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and I could have gone Nightmare on Elm Street 3, The Dream Warriors, because it's just pure fun video game kind of and full of wonderful homages and some of the best Freddy jokes and that kind of thing, but you know, the way that Nightmare on Elm Street plays out, I think that there's so much repetition, and it just became more and more clever ways of Robert Englund to do really horrible things to teenagers. and as clever as that is, I mean, it makes it a sort of an engaging franchise, and I know that there's legions of fans out there, but there's nothing particularly new.
Sure.
Sometimes they would be better told, but a new nightmare is, it's the... Hey, we're going to put the actors as themselves, and then we're going to have Wes Craven playing Wes Craven,
right?
And Heather Langenkamp being playing herself and a fake husband. It would have been awesome if she had a real husband who would actually,
right.
You know,
right.
gets lunched and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But
now, you know, I have not seen A New Nightmare.
Oh man,
I know.
The problem is,
full disclosure.
You're completely forgiven, because at this point it was a tired franchise.
Right.
I think after four, it just like I wasn't interested in it. But
I think where I sort of left off at that point. Well, I've subsequently gone back and, you know, picked apart some of the pieces and parts of Nightmare on Elm Street. But the place where I left off was, you know, Freddy in 3D, and I was like, okay, this is totally absurd,
right? You know, and then there's some things like I'm not gonna do, you know, like I think Freddy versus Jason is as dorky as you know, Frankenstein meets the Wolfman. I mean, at a certain point, yeah, I know that you kind of want to see them go at each other, but it doesn't make any sense. They shouldn't be connected universes,
right?
The beauty of, I think, the way that Nightmare on Elm Street works is because it's a dream thing, and that's like, oh, he's real, and and you know, the first two guys who get it are special effects guys, get attacked by the claw. There's a lot of cool stuff with New Nightmare. It is maybe one of the best horror movies from the 90s, when we're talking about how there's a big gap because there's been so many sequels.
Right.
You know, and then they got back on the train and started doing, you know, more.
Right.
You know, the more Nightmare on Elm Street stuff, and I think that now is a dead franchise, because I don't think that they can succeed with that franchise without Robert Englund.
No, there's no.
And way.
You can't find an actor. I mean, you say can't, but I mean, I'm sure
they've tried,
I'm sure they will. I'm sure they will.
Jackie Earle Haley, they gave it a swing and swung and missed.
All right, for my number two on the Fearsome Foursome list, I'm going back. This is the 50-year anniversary of this film.
Whoa!
50 years ago.
Okay, oh, wait.
1968.
Oh, God, what would it be?
You're not going to guess this one at all.
Okay.
You're not going to guess it. Do you want to try?
Is it a Dario Argento?
Nope.
Okay.
This is the film directed by Ishiro Honda.
Oh,
this is the 1968.
Is this Destroy All Monsters?
Destroy All Monsters.
Yes!
This was not the second in the Godzilla franchise, or the third, or the fourth, or the fifth, or the sixth, or the seventh, or the eighth. It was the ninth in the Godzilla franchise.
Yeah. High watermark for Toho right here. Well, maybe.
Oh my God! Does it ever? Because you had 11 different kaiju monsters. 11 kaiju monsters.
I love this movie.
You had some Rodan. You had some Mothra. You had some Ghidorah.
You had the caterpillars.
You had the caterpillars. I don't know if Hidora was in this. That's the
Hidora.
That was the smog monster. But basically, the story with Destroy All Monsters, if you have not seen it, which I do recommend it, involves a group of space aliens known as the Kelax, who have released the giant monsters from Monsterland, which I didn't know that was a thing, and they've implanted mind control devices in the kaiju monsters to control them. The monsters, of course, are eventually freed from the mind control, which leads the aliens to release King Ghidorah, not just plain old Ghidorah, but King Ghidorah from outer space to challenge the monsters. And it ends with maybe the best ending of any film of all time, the monsters having a dance party.
Yeah. Slash SmackDown.
But then they do have when the monsters from Monsterland, Planet Earth monsters, not the King Ghidorah alien monsters or the Kelak monsters, the space alien monsters, when the monsters on planet Earth when they eventually do the dance party.
Well, I know that there is look it up on YouTube, but there's a Godzilla doing like these dance, like ballet moves.
Yes.
I'm trying to remember.
There are definitely some ballet moves on this.
That is, I love that. It's like not
super fun movie.
Not scary at all, but it is.
But it fits in the loosely fits in the horror genre.
Yeah.
and you know, I just wanted to give a shout out to Toho.
I wanted to give
a shout out just because, like, in terms of like. You know, I feel like it's, the stuff that they did is, you know, somewhat tantamount to, like, I don't know, like somebody like Prince or somebody like George Clinton or somebody like Elvis Costello, where it's like there's such a massive body of work and it's all connected, right? Like all this Godzilla stuff is connected.
Well,
and there are just so many films.
It's, the Marvel Cinematic Universe. That's the Toho Cinematic Universe.
Yeah. I would have felt remiss had I not talked about Godzilla at some point.
Because we
did. Go back to episode, I'm going to say 6 or 7. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're so many episodes into this. Go back to episode 6 or 7 and you can learn a little something about the best monster movies of all time.
Yep.
All right. So what do you got for your number one on the Fearsome Foursome list the greatest sequels of all time?
So this is, so I'm going in chronological order here.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Very
close to present day. And this was when I was saying that I've got a number two on my, movie two of two, and it's almost certainly going to be a three.
Mm-hmm.
This is The Conjuring 2.
Oh, we got a crossover.
Okay.
That's good. That was my number one as well. So let's talk the Enfield House.
Yeah, I think the reason why I picked this one over some other movies, like I bypassed Aliens because I think that it's, I think Aliens, again, is a more of an action movie than a monster movie. I bypassed Evil Dead 2, which I adore because I think it's more of a remake than a
sequel.
Now,
what about Army of Darkness, though?
I'll be honest.
You think that's a sequel, or is it like kind of a standalone?
No, it's
piece?
That one's more of a sequel. That's a sequel to Evil Dead 2.
Sure.
I am not. I know some people like Army of Darkness a lot.
Yeah.
I thought it was fine. But it's not one. You know, when I think of it, it's like. If I'm going back to that franchise, I'm watching Evil Dead 2 again.
Yeah.
Or maybe the first one. But
yeah, it's fun. It's silly. It's not scary.
Right.
Yeah. Evil Dead 2 is to scary films as is Godzilla, King of Monsters, King of All Monsters.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that this is The Conjuring 2 is the right way to do a horror sequel where you're still following the Warrens, right? And I think it's the acting skill of Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga help. They were a huge benefit to the first film.
Mm-hmm.
Whole new family, and the neat thing is that they can. That there's an excuse for it. That they're they're investigators. That this is a new case, and that it fits nicely within to this kind of a program. And I think you again found a very compelling family who's under duress.
Mm-hmm.
I like the fact that this.
But they actually touch on another family under duress in this film because they actually touch on the Amityville.
Right.
They touch on the Lutz family.
Right.
Very loosely, which I'm thinking that's
Conjuring 3.
That's or the setup. Yeah, that's Conjuring 4.
Right. Well, and here's like James Wan has breathed so much life into this franchise,
mm-hmm.
and he knows how to set up a shot. He knows how to hold the suspense, when to step on the gas, when to pull off. There's some light. Sometimes there's a little bit of light humor in there, but for the most part, he keeps the tension built up. I mean, it was fantastic in the first one.
Mm-hmm.
In that you, the tension again, R-rated movie for no other reason than tension.
Right.
And again, this
you know what I remember when I was watching this the first time I watched it. Well, actually, the only time I watched it, you and I watched it.
Mm-hmm.
When we watched it, I remember thinking, you know, where the Warrens decide to leave the Enfield house, right, mm-hmm. and go back to the United States, and then they like, you know, they go, oh my gosh, we have to go back, and I was like, well, this is really silly. Like it seemed so like clumsy the way they did it, but right. now, like looking back on it, it's pretty masterful. It's pretty mm-hmm. It's an interesting little twist to the film.
Yeah, well, and the idea that they have reached a certain level of fame in what they do.
Yeah,
and that there are hoaxers.
Yeah,
right, and that there are people who are doubters, and that they're running headlong into it, but they don't. You know, under a lesser director, it would have been kind of ham-fisted, and you would have gotten something moral head graveyard shift or something. You know, it's like you got to be kind of careful what kind of a touch you put on this thing. And he's figured it out, and so I have faith.
You know who else had the right touch? The marketing department.
Yeah.
I didn't know that they did this, and I went back and looked at some of it. The marketing department, like several weeks out before the film was released, they teased out a 360-degree tour of the Enfield house. So you could walk through the house. And then they teased out all these audio recordings that were allegedly found at the Enfield house. And then they teased out an audio recording of the demon. I mean, you know, that's pretty brilliant. You know, and the fact that, you know, the fact that the fact that the Blair Witch project set up a lot of those kinds of things 20 years
ago. The viral marketing,
The viral marketing and just some simple little mm-hmm. tricks and, you know, just some simple little, like, you know, video audio tricks. The fact that not a lot of people are doing that and the fact that these guys employed those mm-hmm. those devices is pretty cool. Yeah. I thought that was really cool.
It never felt stale.
Mm-mm.
It was a fresh take on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's introduced two villainous creatures in mm-hmm. the Nun and the Crooked Man that are getting their own spin-offs. If Juan's not behind it, I don't have a whole lot of faith in the Nun. As creepy as that Nun was,
yeah.
We'll see
in July if that Nun is indeed creepy. September.
I think it's been bumped. I think it's a September release. Don't hold me to that. But
okay.
I've been hearing that they've been struggling. We haven't gotten a full trailer yet.
Right,
and that's not a good sign.
No. Check back with us to see if the Nun is indeed creepy.
So, Conjuringverse, I mean, it's as long as Juan comes back to handle the reins, or if he finds someone of like skill, like maybe a Lee Whannell, or someone who was actually involved with, I think also the Insidious projects,
right.
and that kind of stuff. I think, you know, we're able to expand this universe and continue the stories without making it just like a joke a minute kind of a thing, like or the killing by numbers that the Friday the 13th movies and Halloween movies have become.
Assuming Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga don't get too old.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing
fast.
Is, that,
although the Warrens were kicking around into their 70s, and I think she's still alive, isn't she?
I don't know.
I think one of them is still alive. I think one of them actually is still alive.
Mike, look that up.
I will. Or somebody, please look that up. All right. Well, I think that's a pretty good list. So yeah. let's recap again here real quickly. Sure. So we know The Conjuring 2 is on the list. Mm-hmm. What else do you got for us?
So chronologically, yes. 1935, The Bride of Frankenstein.
Bride of Frankenstein. Yes.
1977, Dawn of the Dead.
Yes.
1994, Wes Craven's A New Nightmare. Mike, you should check that out.
And Conjuring 2. And
Conjuring 2.
All right. In non-chronological order, Phantasm 2.
Okay.
1988 action horror film.
Mm-hmm. With four-barreled shotgun.
Paranormal Activity 2, 2010.
Mm-hmm.
The Kaiju Great Destroy All Monsters from 1968, celebrating its 50th anniversary. And, of course, the 2016 Conjuring 2. All right, let's go. Let's get to that point in the podcast where we go grave digging.
Dig, dig, dig.
All right, so what do you got for us this week in the grave?
Well, I've got a kind crypt. Of a fun one.
All right.
So our colleague and friend Robert
yes.
has been... What up, Robert? We have now started to get requests from filmmakers
yes.
wanting us to review their films.
And that's so you. That yes. is you.
So
listening hey, right now.
Filmmakers, we are willing. We are not too proud to take a look at your stuff.
Ready, willing, and able.
So there's a director, F.C. Rabath, who did a movie called A Brilliant Monster.
Mm-hmm.
It's a movie about ritual sacrifice and a self-help guru.
Yep.
And Robert gave it...
Sounds a little like A Dark Place, maybe?
A little bit. Not quite so somber a
term.
This is more of a... But there's, sacrifice as in ritual human sacrifice kind of stuff. And so this movie is still... So we got an exclusive early review of it. It's going to hit the film circuit for... I don't know, maybe next year. I'll have to take a look at the... Robert, go read the article on scariestthings.com, and you'll be able to see where it's going to be showing and if there's a festival near you that you want to check it out.
Yeah.
And then, but we're... I think it's one of those kinds of things where it's fun to get stuff. We've got another one that's coming up soon that I think Amy's going to review. So, you know, send us your stuff. We'll give an honest appraisal.
Yeah.
So be cognizant of that. But it's now I think saying that we're getting a little bit of reach, and so I'm awfully proud of that.
Yeah. Very cool. Very, very cool. All right. So my grave digging news. Apparently, the Brian De Palma, who directed such greats as Sisters
mm-hmm.
and many others, is prepping a new horror film.
Oh.
And it is called Predator. Not Predator versus Aliens. Not the return of Predator, but it is Predator inspired by the Harvey Weinstein.
Oh!
It is apparently what Brian De Palma is describing as a horror film with a sexual aggressor within the context of sexual harassment in Hollywood.
Yeah.
So Brian De Palma might be getting a little old. Brian De Palma might be running out of story ideas.
No,
but I think this could be a very interesting mashup.
You know what would have been better?
Much like the same way that Get Out, you know, took an interesting spin on race relations. Maybe Brian De Palma is on to something.
You know what? I wish it was?
What?
Roman Polanski doing it.
Yes, that would be the ultimate in the irony.
Yeah.
The ultimate in irony.
And if you, I think I was just harkening back to our previous podcast where I reviewed Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde,
right.
Who is the embodiment of the 1930s Me Too movement.
Yes.
Right, where it's like, creepy dude threatening and abusing women.
Yes, Dr. Weinstein and Mr. Weinstein.
Yes, right. So he's on his public face. He's an insincere, egotistical maniac, and in his private world, he's a monster. So that's going to be that'll be interesting.
It will. All right. Well, good podcast. Good run. So number 26.
Yeah, 26.
Not bad.
Good job, Mike.
Not bad. All right, good job to you. All right, so before we leave, quick tagline from the 1974 classic, It's Alive. There's only one thing that's wrong with the Davis baby. It's alive.